Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine that loves freedom even more than certain presidential offspring love crack. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and the returning special guest star, Stephanie Slade. Welcome back, everyone.
Happy Monday.
Thanks.
Hey, Matt.
So there's new fresh polling data out this very Monday morning that we're recording this to you, late morning, and it's just brutal for President Joseph Robinette Biden II. Only 26% of Democratic voters are saying that the party should even renominate the dude in 2024, according to a New York Times Siena College telephone survey of 850 registered voters. I have to do this more with more specificity when Slade's on the podcast. This is a margin of error, plus or minus 4.1%, Slade. This was from July 5th to July 7th that this survey was taken. So it was after the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision overturning Roe versus Wade. Per the Times write-up, more than three quarters of registered voters see the United States moving in the wrong direction. A pervasive sense of pessimism that spans every corner of the country, every age range and racial group, cities, suburbs, rural areas, as well as both political parties. Yikes. Biden's approval rating is in the turlet, 33% per that poll, but it's been around in the high 30s for basically the poll of polls for a while now. Unsurprisingly, this public opinion vacuum, if that's what we can call it, is generating a lot of campaign jockeying already here in July 2022. God help us all. California Governor Gavin Newsom, yes, that guy, is running ads against his presumed Florida counterpart, GOP heavyweight Ron DeSantis, wiggling himself, meaning Newsom, in place should Biden pull some kind of LBJ 1968 situation. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is out there doing the smooth talk thing on Fox News. Vice President Kamala Harris is trying to word salad her way into meaningfulness. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, Biden's fellow old person, Donald Trump, is teasing, unconvincingly, I think, an early field clearing announcement of his own candidacy. And because it's presidential silly season already, a little earlier than usual, various unserious people are trial ballooning such nonsenses as John Stewart should run for president. Nick.
He'd be great. He's so funny.
Insightful. Go read Ben Dreyfus on this, is what I would
relevant.
Encourage everybody. Nick, you've pointed out on this program in the past that even the sainted Ronald Wilson Reagan, 666 himself, was polling there.
Agent of Satan.
Was polling in the crappy mid-40s at this point in his presidency, as were Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, Barack Hussein Obama, and of course Donald Trump.
James Garfield. He was actually polling at zero at this point in his presidency.
Is there something to you about the current...
That was with the heart rate monitor?
He really collapsed in... No. Just across the board.
Does this current moment feel different to you than those, or is it more kind of a continuity of crud?
Yeah, it does feel different. And I do want to point out, Matt, though, and you alluded to it, that this poll was taken before the 4chan release of Hunter Biden phone logs, messages, photos, which I think is going to raise... People are going to want to keep Biden around for a little bit longer based on that. He was Hunter apparently was calling his father Pedo Pete in some of his email contacts and phone messages and things like that. There's a lot there that I think I'm going to spend the rest of my career just kind of digging through.
How is that just not at the very least leading all like comedy outlets at all times?
I was going to say I don't know how you feel about him now, but Albert Pujols he's the Cinderella man for this summer of our discontent, Matt Welch.
You're not going to bait me into this, Nick.
He's breaking, you know, he's moving up the charts. And I see the other two people on the phone call, like, have no idea who I'm talking about.
That's fine.
Which is okay. Yeah, it is different.
I read reviews of the movie Cinderella Man.
Surprisingly, not a trans, you know, a cross-dressing trans triumph, which I'm sure if it was remade today, it would be, right? It would be set in a public library during a drag time story hour. But yeah, it is different, Matt. And it's not different because Biden could still turn something around. The best thing that can happen to him on a certain level is that the Republicans take, you know, the midterms and then reveal themselves to be the awful, you know, creature from Jekyll Island or whatever that they really are. But it is bad. It's, you know, it is rare when you have all of the indicators doing this bad. And Joe Biden is a spectacularly incompetent, uninspiring chief executive. You know, and there's no reason to rank him historically or anything like that. But this is an old, infirm man whose policies are directly, you know, linked to the problems that we have. You know, we have inflation in large part because of policies that Joe Biden pursued, enacted, was successful at. Like, this is where it's the same thing with Obama, where it was a little bit different when Obama got wiped out, when the Democrats got wiped out in the 2010 midterms. People are like, I don't understand it. You know, Obama accomplished so much. And it was like, no, it was exactly what Obama accomplished that led to him, his party getting shellacked, as he put it. That's part of the problem with Biden. And then you have a guy who is simply, you know, is clearly not up to a second term, which is what people are thinking about when they think about him. It's one thing, maybe he can finish out this term, but it's also, you know, the Democrats are in a really difficult situation because the best thing for the party and maybe even for the country would be for him to admit, like, I'm not running for re-election because I don't even know where I am. You know, just put me back on the, why is the exercise bike? Why does it keep falling over? You know, that type of thing. But he can't do that for all sorts of reasons, including for, you know, national security and things like that. But so I do think it's different. There is also a larger torpor in America that goes back at least to the Trump ascendancy and whatnot. I mean, I would actually peg it as going back to the Bush administration in the 21st century. You know, what we are doing, and I'll end with this grand thesis, that, you know, what we are doing is we are unwinding the false age of experts, of the best and the brightest that the 20th century represented. The idea that, you know, smart people at the top of the pyramid can call all the shots. The 20th century, you know, that peaked about 1950, 1960, and we're still unwinding it. And Joe Biden is just going to be the last guy, you know, to turn out the lights if he can actually get his 80-year-old hands to slap hard enough to turn off the clapper on the 20th century and turn out the lights.
Peter, building on Nick's ageism here, you live in D.C. How many more of those people are finally starting to talk about Biden's age articles do there have to be before we realize that people are starting to talk about Biden's age and that his age-related fitness for office is a real live issue?
I think the answer specifically to your question is zero. There need to be zero more articles because we are now talking about Biden's age and it is an issue. And it's telling that the Biden administration is having to put out statements saying Biden will run for president in 2024. It's 2022 here. He's the president of the United States. He just won it's obviously not, wasn't a landslide victory, but it was a clear victory, you know, not too long ago there were Democratic losses in the House, but even still, Democrats pulled out a kind of unexpected upset to have a slim, you know, the slimmest possible majority in the Senate, right? He's got the trifecta. And so he is someone who he's the leader of the party. He is, you know, sort of the figurehead for the Democratic Party at the moment. And there's a real problem with that because Joe Biden doesn't appear to actually be able or willing or able to do the job that a party figurehead is supposed to do, which is to lay out a clear vision for the party and the country. And this is something that I've said before on this podcast, but there is a sense in which Joe Biden is not really leading here. Instead, he is just sort of, he's acting as a kind of average maker, right? Like, it's almost as if he's just sort of taking all the ideas from the rest of the party and averaging them out, and then that's what you get from Joe Biden, and you don't get anything that's really obviously him. He's not serving as the kind of person who's like, oh, look, you will follow me. I have this good idea. I have this vision for a better America. I think there was a real problem, you know, sort of an unexplored contradiction, I should say, in the way that Biden ran for president. Because there were two ways to look at his campaign. And one was he campaigned on a return to normal. And the other was he campaigned on, you know, we're not going to do big structural change in the way that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren want to. Instead, we're going to do big government, right? We're going to do these huge spending plans. And so we got a whole bunch of the spending. We got $2 trillion from the American Rescue Plan right after Biden came into office. We got another half trillion or trillion, depending on how you look at it, from the infrastructure plan last year. And the rest of his agenda was, you know, however many trillions of dollars the Build Back Better is at any given moment. And the agenda, that spending agenda, has actually helped prevent anything like a return to normal. Because, the biggest single issue here is inflation, is just prices, is that people are very upset when they look at grocery store prices, when they fill up their tank of gas. And Biden came out of the gate with big spending ambitions, some of which passed, some of which he spent last year trying to pass, some of which he is still, at least in theory, trying to pass. And all of that stuff has contributed to the ways in which this, you know, America in 2022 still does not feel like it has returned to normal. And Biden doesn't have any way to get us there, because his idea for how we were going to return to normal was Donald Trump wouldn't be president and Joe Biden would eat ice cream and, you know, pose for pictures with his Camaro or something.
Slade, I'm obviously trying to trigger you by basing a first segment on a poll when you're on. You know, I'm doing that on purpose. Can you remind us, because we do this on many seasons when we bring you on the podcast, what are useful and non-useful things that political polls are telling us right now, or polls that have to do with the president or a future president telling us right now? How should we, as savvy, knowledgeable consumers, be using polls in July 2022?
The thing that I like to always begin by pointing out is that we should be careful about putting too much stock in what a poll says right now in terms of making predictions about how people are going to vote in 8 months or 10 months or a year and a half. Because just so much could change between now and then. So you don't want to look at a poll taken today and say, okay, based on this poll in which, you know, Biden beats Trump by 4 percentage points, we can conclude that Biden is more likely to win, you know, a head-to-head matchup against Trump next year. It's just too early. So much could change. But what's interesting about these you know, polls taken right now and the situation this year is that it is more of a live question than usual in a president's first term whether the sitting president will decide to run for re-election or not at all. I mean, the White House is insisting that he will. You know, he is running, but I think nobody thinks that that's a sure thing. And so although the polls taken today don't necessarily tell us how voters would vote in November of, you know, 2024, They do potentially say something. You know, they're going to influence the decision that is made at the White House about whether or not he's going to run or not. And this is a really interesting and important question, because obviously the answer determines everything else that's going to happen over the next two and a half years. But the longer it takes Biden to make a final decision about whether or not he's running, the longer that drags out, the more uncertainty there is, you know, among everybody else who's trying to weigh whether or not to jump in. Or, you know, for the most part, it's unlikely that anybody's going to challenge him, anybody seriously challenge him. But everybody's sort of sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what the president is going to do. And nobody knows the answer to that question yet. And what the polls tell him today, presumably, and how they unfold over the next few months will, you know, influence that decision. So there is actually a lot riding on these polls today, even if it's still important to begin by recognizing that they don't tell us very much about how people are going to vote a year or more in the future.
Yeah, you have to imagine that there are Democratic Party leaders who want to win elections and are looking at the polls that say that Biden's approval rating is 33%. That's not mid-40s. That's not, you know, sort of, this doesn't seem to be going so well. That is catastrophically bad. And the same polls also say that only about a quarter of Democrats want Biden to run again in 2024. And so that's where I think the age issue is going to come in. If there is an argument that Democratic Party leadership is going to make to Joe Biden, it's, look, dude, they're going to pitch it to him this way is, look, you did what you needed to do and you defeated Trump. You got the country back, you know, on some kind of footing. They'll make an argument to him that, oh, actually, the economy is much better than it seems because of hiring rates, because of, you know, that sort of thing. And but you're just aging out of the ability to do it. And we need some fresh blood in here. And so I think that, you know, in some ways, to go back to your earlier question, Matt, about the number of stories that we are starting to see about Biden's age, what those stories indicate is that it's no longer just Biden's Republican critics. It's no longer just people who sort of naturally would dislike Biden who are talking about this. This is, you know, this is being put on the front page of the New York Times. This is going to be something that is talked about in Democratic leadership circles and is going to be the kind of thing that is going to get to Biden potentially himself.
Well, this New York Times poll, that brand new fresh numbers that we were talking about earlier, among people who say that they plan to vote in the Democratic primary, of those, a large percentage say that they are hoping for fresh blood. Yeah. And asked why, a third of them.
Because they're vampires.
A third of them.
On the American Corp.
Name Biden's age. So this is voters responding to a poll with that as the number one leading reason why they would prefer to see somebody else be the Democratic nominee.
And the age thing theoretically gives Biden like an honorable way to bow out rather than saying, hey, I blew it.
To take a stair lift out to San Clemente.
You know, I'm in my 80s.
That could be part of Build Back Better. A transcontinental stairlift to wherever Biden wants to retire.
All I know is that two of the more youthful politicians in these United States are Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom. So,
yeah. Well, I was going to say, to walk back some of the ageism a little bit, you don't see these same questions about people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. You do about Trump because it's clear Trump's neuroplasticity, like that guy needs 1,000 micrograms of LSD to kind of, spark a little bit of neuroplasticity in his brain. He's declined, but it's not simply
age. I think
he
just needs one of those apps where you play word games.
Yeah, that's true. In the shower, right? Or when he's combing and when he's having his hair combed for him. But to go to, this, Matt, is even more disturbing. And this conceivably helps Biden. Like when waiting in the wings is Gavin Newsom and Ron DeSantis, people could be like, holy cow, this next generation. I mean, where suddenly England looks good, where Queen Elizabeth is going to be 1,000 years old, but she's doing whatever, she's getting blood boys direct from Peter Thiel in order to keep going, to keep Prince Charles off the throne.
She's drinking gin all day long. And I'm not making that. If you guys ever get a chance, look up her drinking regimen. She is kind of tipsy from about 11 a.m.
That fucking purse. What do you think's in that pocketbook? It's lined. It's like a, it's waterproof. And she just tips up the end and drinks a little sip from it.
Two and like the queen.
I have been switching to a queen like regimen this very summer, as a matter of fact, in her honor. And that's, we're going to talk a little bit more in the near immediate future.
I don't want to hear about your personal life.
It's too late. It's just far too late.
Sexual perversions and things like that.
Slade, I wanted to get you talking a little bit about abortion polling. Just because that it's fun for everybody. But I saw on 538 and circulated the immediate post-Dobbs polling, the first six polls showed a measurable little uptick towards Democrats in the midterms. I don't know where this latest New York Times poll comes out on that. Do we have information that tells us about the political impact of the Dobbs decision yet, as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, not really. I would say even if you look at what 538 is publishing on this, they're saying, look, it's really too early to be making predictions about whether this decision will influence the midterms in any way. The sort of generic ballot and the types of poll questions that people are keeping an eye on are just notoriously noisy anyway. So you don't want to be drawing conclusions based on a tiny uptick taken, you know, a few days after a big news event. I would caution against putting a lot of stock in that or making any predictions, as I always caution against making predictions after the, you know, spectacular failure of all my predictions 4 years ago.
Well, speaking of, yeah.
You know, though, Matt, if I may, where I think we see a Democratic strategy, you know, by all historical analysis and by all kind of basic indicators now where, you know, the country, everybody thinks the country's headed in the wrong direction. This is the first midterm election of a president who's under 50% approval ratings, et cetera. We're looking, you know, if history holds, he's going to lose somewhere between 25 and 40 seats in the House and probably lose the Senate. Like, it's going to be a blowout. What the Democrats can do, and I can see them stitching together this, they have nothing to run on because their economic policies, you know, which they got through and things like that have fucked things up royally. They can go a culture war route, which the Republicans also want to do because, you know, it's amazing. The Republicans are poised to take over Congress and you have no idea what they will do. Mitch McConnell is like completely even more vaporous than normal.
Mitch McConnell just doesn't exist. Explicitly said, I believe it was in January. Somebody asked him, it was a reporter, what is the Republican agenda if you guys win in the midterms? And Mitch McConnell's response was something very close to elect us and you'll find out. Literally, I'm not going
thanks.
To tell
That's
you. And
great,
then Rick
right?
Scott,
yeah.
Senator Rick Leadership. Scott, released like a 40-page, you know, 10-point plan for Republicans. And Mitch McConnell was
Slapped
really mad because he had, was really mad that that a Republican had the
and
gall to release an actual policy agenda.
Yeah. And half of Rick Scott's points in that, it was like, if people know the Ramones song Commando, where there's four rules that you're supposed to follow, and it's like, eat kosher salami, be nice to mommy. Like, Rick Scott's plan was mostly idiotic, like beyond belief. But
yes, clearly
what I'm getting
not
at,
an endorsement
Democrats,
of Rick Scott's agenda.
Oh, yeah. You know, and always with Rick Scott, everything, it's always more urine testing. Because that's, he runs a drug testing company. He's like a urine fanatic, really. Disturbing and extremist. But what the Democrats can do, riffing off of Dobbs and the Supreme Court most recently, is, you know, you take abortion, gun rights, environmental protections. And, you know, that this court is so much more complicated than just being, oh, it's like ultra conservative or whatever. It's like it's mixed, but they can start saying to their base and then trying to expand it out to moderates, like, you, here is what's happening. Environmental rights are going out the window, like environmental policy. This court and the Republicans, it's a conservative court appointed by Republicans. They're going to, you know, have us all drinking Flint, you know, water bottled in Flint, Michigan. They are going to come after your reproductive autonomy. They are going to arm, you know, the only, you know, they're going to arm, you know, unborn children who come shooting out of vaginas. So, you know, that is the death, you know, the kind of like doomsday scenario that Democrats are going to have to start to paint in order to get any traction in the midterms like that. And of course, the Republicans will be happy to do that because they're already, you know, somebody like Ron DeSantis, as much as he might talk about economic policy or things, how the economy is going well in Florida and other Republicans, you know, they really, really, really want to talk about how every Democrat is a groomer. You know, and that, like, you know, you're looking forward to a world where nothing gets done except the sexual exploitation of children in public schools.
Not to talk about any other podcast that's not a Reason branded podcast while we're talking on this Reason Roundtable podcast, but I was listening to a former Congressman Justin Amash, who we've Nick has and others have been interviewing. And he's got a podcast of his own, and he was mentioning that DeSantis, who was in Congress for a while, that Amash has been doing his own libertarian scorecard of members of Congress over the years. And shockingly, Justin Amash comes out on top of the scorecard, strangely enough, with like low, like 100, and then Thomas Massey is at 97. But he mentioned in his most recent episode that DeSantis got a 20. that like just super not very libertarian at all, regard even before we get to how he's governed like a culture war.
But that was mostly because DeSantis wouldn't let Amash work in on like the bench press in the congressional gym, right? It's you got to look at the details.
Suns out, guns out.
Of the questions.
Yeah. One thing that brought American politics in kind of sharp relief last week, and our kind of unhealthily, you know, the obsessed way that we look at presidential politics in general. The reason we do that is because all this power has accrued to the executive branch over time, and the legislative branch is basically a clown show of camera-hogging people who don't really have any effect on legislation, something that Justin Amash has talked about to great effect in the pages of Reason Magazine and the Pixels or whatever the hell. At any rate, last week, the mop-headed, also clown-like, although he's a pretty good writer, Boris Johnson, Prime Minister of England, was shown the door by his own party. He's basically impelled to resign because so many of his cabinet members resigned and a bunch of other things besides. And this all came about kind of originally because he was throwing parties during the lockdown period that other people weren't allowed to throw. Feels kind of small beer. And I saw a lot of people slayed. I know you're the Anglophile among us for some reason that it escapes me. I saw some American commentators kind of,
I think you're just saying that because I just happened to be in London.
That's an important thing. You like the Queen. You drink gin.
So you're traveling to enemy capitals
exactly.
and reporting from there?
Exactly. Get you banned from country and Western radio stations.
Fact check. Oh, no. Slade does not like
gin?
Gin.
That's okay. Right. I'm not a gin
yet.
Drinker. Nope.
There's still time left for you. I can testify through personal experience, Nick. Anyway, Slade, I see people saying like, gosh, how refreshing that a political party, you know, would suffer some kind of spasm of principle and would be willing to toss someone for what seems like a rounding error of like Trump excesses. Maybe there's something about ye old parliamentary system that America could learn from. What say you? Are there American lessons from the British fiasco?
I wish. I mean, I found it absolutely infuriating over the last 2 years watching the mayor of Washington, D.C., the governor of California, and on these people hand down restrictions that the rest of us were expected to abide by, you know, with threats of use of government force against us if we didn't comply, and then just, you know, shamelessly break their own rules by going to parties, by going out to eat at fancy restaurants, by, you know, in one case, officiating a wedding without a mask one day after the mask mandate in D.C. went, you know, back into place, and getting caught over and over and over again and never once being forced to apologize or, you know, being subjected to any kind of consequences for this behavior. I found it infuriating. And so in that sense, I am kind of, I wish we might see somebody be held accountable here the way Boris Johnson is being held accountable in at least part for his violations along those lines. But I think there are some pretty big differences between the situation there and the situation here that make me not very hopeful that anything like this is going to happen. I mean, the main one being, you just have a system in place there where the expectation, I mean, it's structured in such a way that the party is supposed to hold the person, the prime minister or the party leader accountable, where you essentially serve at the pleasure of your fellow co-partisans, where the idea of a vote of no confidence is a thing that is built in and can happen at any time. It is expected to happen. It regularly happens. We just don't have that here, right? Our system isn't structured in a way where it's easy for members of a party to do anything about the leader of the party, an elected leader of the party who is embarrassing them. It just requires these really extreme measures, whether an impeachment and a conviction or the invoking of the 25th Amendment to remove someone from office here. And that's, you know, it's historically unprecedented. It's not a thing you're likely to see. It would be a very, very big deal in a way that it just isn't when, you know, a prime minister loses.
It's also that in the American system, there's a direct disincentive to do so, because if a party takes out its own president, then at least in terms of messaging, the message to the public is vote for the other party in the United States. And it's a nearly surefire way to put your partisan enemies into office. And that is something that, especially in today's hyper-polarized, hyper-partisan political environment, no party wants to do. I think it's a problem. I think it creates big issues for political parties in the United States. But the incentive is pretty clear that if you want to win elections, which is what parties are there to do, parties are increasingly do not exist to pass agendas. They just exist to win elections in order to keep winning elections, especially the Republican Party. And in order to so if you think of winning elections as goal number one, then the incentive is always to support your president, no matter how ridiculous, no matter what it is he or she is doing.
Two quick points, Matt. First off, Boris Johnson has been a failure as prime minister. So this, I think it's wrong to say, oh, you know, he's getting kicked out because finally people understood that he was having parties during lockdowns that he ordered. His entire, you know, regimen during COVID was idiotic. He has been a terrible implementer of Brexit, which he ran on and then kind of dithered about, et cetera. So this is the straw that broke the camel's back for him. So apart from all of the questions about parliamentary systems versus our system here. But the other thing is that the Republican Party has actually shown a willingness to discipline its own people. Ask Liz Cheney, ask Adam Kinzinger, ask people like Justin Amash. But, you know, Liz Cheney was formerly censured by the Wyoming Party or the Republican Party of Wyoming and things like that. So you do see something. It's not the same, but it is equivalent.
So they're not being censured or disciplined for bad behavior. They're being
so what?
Censured,
I mean, all of it's
for
no,
speaking
for politics,
out against
for
other
politics.
Republicans.
It's always about politics. Impeachment. I think I read, and I know I wrote multiple times, had reason, but like during the various impeachment things, impeachment is always a political process. So, Boris Johnson getting kicked out, it's not because the English are principled or the Tory party is principled. It's political. And they're sensing like this is going to fuck us up. So,
yeah, well, when you lose the
confidence, it's different,
of the base,
but it's also similar.
Yeah.
Go Slate.
When you lose the confidence of the people, then the party is going to abandon you. And that's just a thing that never happened when it came to the Republican base in the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, it happened with Nixon. Nixon left because people like Barry Goldwater and other emissaries from within the Republican Party were like, okay, Dick, it's time to hit the hike, you know, hit the road.
Yeah, that's we'll see if that kind of thing happens in our lifetime, in our rapidly expiring lifetime, Nick Gillespie. All right, we're going to get, speaking of rapid expiring lifetime, we're going to get to our listener email of the week. I don't know why that's speaking of here in a moment.
I am terrified to hear what ad you are about to introduce after talking about rapidly expiring life.
But first, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. You know, friends, a mind is a terrible thing to waste, as we know, and it's also a terrible thing to take for granted. Just let run on autopilot as life throws you any number of difficult challenges professionally, personally, physically, emotionally. Keeping the old noggin healthy is worth putting some work into, and that's where BetterHelp online therapy comes in. BetterHelp is customized online therapy delivered via video, phone, live chat, or any newfangled way you'd prefer to receive some third-party counseling. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy. You can be matched with a professional in under 48 hours, and if you don't like him or her, you can switch them out. Roundtable listeners get 10% off their first month. Just go to betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Go there today. Your brain will be glad you did. Okay. As a reminder, please send your email, your succinct queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one, which wasn't succinct, but I'm editing it, comes from Michelle Levin, who writes a bunch of nice stuff about us and especially about Catherine, who's not here, so screw that, and then gets to it. I heard about Dutch farmer protests on the social media website, not revealing which one because it's too cringy.
Wow.
And I tried
to
find...
Do you think it's only dutchfarmers.com?
It's Parler.
A dating site for Dutch farmers?
And I tried. Do you remember like that the truck stop, like a Russian bride, like a circular Nick back in like the 90s?
I do not, Matt Welch.
Okay. We're looking at different media.
I think so.
Back to Michelle. And I tried to find out more about what was happening on the interwebs. Couldn't find much coverage in U.S. media. But best I can gather is that the Netherlands adopted a new program to reduce nitrogen emissions that will require farmers to destroy up to 30% of their livestock by 2030, which the farmers say will be economically devastating. Well, yeah, it would be wonderful to have the experts, strong language, on the roundtable shed some light on what is happening and whether this is a good use of government power. I would also like your thoughts on climate change, governmental policies generally. They always seem to be ham-fisted. I get that. I see what you did there. Arbitrary and short-sighted, or fail to take into account the unintended consequences. And I use quotes because if they were thought through better, these consequences would not be so surprising, etc. Nick, please take the lead either on the specifics of the Dutch pig protest, which involved fire hosing feces, by the way, it's pretty exciting, or the general ham-fistedness of climate-related policies.
Well, as you know, Matt, I stand only second to Michael Caine in my hatred of the Dutch. So I, I can't even read about the Dutch. I've had them blocked from my VPN.
Some people don't like Nethers.
Like 1988, yeah. Now, I love the Dutch, and I particularly grew up in the 70s in the heyday of the Dutch soccer, national soccer team, which just created a new, it was essentially the kind of the equivalent of a run and gun offense, but it was actually closer to what an old basketball coach, national basketball coach I was briefly related to, Jerry Walk, did press, pass, and sprint. Matt Welch, the Dutch national team was on offense, like it was the equivalent of a full court press and offense all at the same time. It was like unbelievable. And so for that reason, I like the Dutch.
It's very exciting for Stephanie Slade.
Yeah. And I'm obviously trying to buy time here. I believe in environmental regulations where I do think that there are commons. Lynn Scarlett, a former president of the Reason Foundation who served in the Bush administration's Department of Interior, wrote a great piece in the late 90s for Reason about a new environmental vision where there are certain types of commons such as air, not as much water or some other resources, but where you do need a political decision made about the acceptable level of pollution. But the whole idea is that once you come to that consensus, which should be as informed as possible by, science, you have to allow markets to find different ways to reach what we might agree on are good goals. And, one of the problems is that government always comes up, or they come up with, here's the problem, here's the solution, here's the technology to fix something. And then that creates many, many problems. And if we could allow, if the government was kind of broadly setting, targets that are acceptable, that are realistic, that are actually good, and then let people find their way to it, that's a superior solution to, kind of flinging, blasting pig feces into, in the general direction of Belgium, which deserves it.
More than deserves it. Slade, this, it kind of strikes me, thinking about it, most like environmental wish list or climate change wish list policies involve making existing use of energy and sourcing of energy more expensive. And we are living in, which sounds great, price carbon or price whatever thing you don't like, extraction that you don't like, and it'll encourage people to use other modes. It strikes me that, pursuant to our previous topic where the rise in prices creates new politics, we might be seeing some kind of drastically new politics in reaction to this, particularly in Europe where energy stuff is way more expensive, but also where there is, this war going on between Russia and Ukraine that is making energy way more expensive. How do you reflect on that in the moment, given the emailers, Michelle's ideas. Is environmentalism creating kind of a reactionary, a potentially reactionary politics out there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with Nick that if you think that there are externalities, that there's a sense in which, you know, choices that people make can sometimes have spillover effects that are negative on other people, then you might think that there is a sometimes a legitimate role for government to try to solve this problem. But, you know, what we're not saying in the Netherlands, and just to be very clear, ain't no experts on any of this subject. So we're doing our best here. But, you know, they're not just, you know, in a thoughtful way saying, hey, there's these externalities, we need to find a way to you know, build laws that account for them and you know, maybe marginally increase the cost of energy so that people will find ways to use less energy or find alternative sources of energy. No, I mean, based on what seems to be happening there, they've handed down almost overnight sort of restrictions on the amount of you know, emissions that they can see in a short amount of time, which is going to cause potentially this destruction of food sources. I mean, this is not just like, okay, let's tweak the price of energy over time so that the markets can adjust. This is like very, sort of dictating particular outcomes that these farmers are now required to just take it, right? Like they have no choice. They have no ability to say, okay, there's different ways to get to this outcome that we think we need to be targeting. No, they're dictating what needs to happen. And nothing makes me more sympathetic to the sort of theses about you know, modern decadence and the idea that we're just going to potentially cut off entire sources of food. I mean, through most of human history, the sort of looming fear of famine or starvation was the greatest threat that humanity faced. And now we've become so arguably decadent that we think it's okay to say like, oh, 30 to 70% of the food in some regions of a country, we're willing to just sort of sacrifice on the altar of our environmental goals without any thoughts for whether starvation might someday again become a legitimate fear that people might face. We don't even think about this anymore. We're so used to having the ability to walk to the store and have access to all the food you could possibly, you know, of wider variety at better prices and a food, you know, it's said a lot, and I'm not in any way making an original point here. But when the sort of biggest problems that the problems that your society faces is obesity and not starvation, you really lose sight of how far we've come and how lucky we are. And so this just, but then the fear is, you know, good times make weak men, make poor choices and bad policy that potentially leads to bad times. And, you know, I really don't want to go back to a place where in the Western world, we're worried about how we're going to feed our children again. I would really like to think that once you solve that problem once, you don't ever have to solve it again. But I really, you know, look at stories like this and I start to question it.
Peter, I'm a generous man. I'm going to give you two options. Door number one is last week, Germany, because of environmentalism, started to dig more coal. Because environmentalists hate nuclear energy and decided that's bad. And so that question behind door number one is it time to do a complete and total shutdown of environmentalism until we can figure out what's going on? And then door number two is something Everglades, because you're from Florida.
Yeah, I'm going to take door number three and talk about the Netherlands.
So it's a wheelbarrow full of rotting cantaloupes.
Right, so...
If I remember, let's make
to
a deal.
Slade's
very well.
Point, the clunker. There is, in fact, a global food shortage right now that is driving up prices in the Western world, which is why everything's expensive here. And it is making food actually quite difficult to get in poorer parts of the world. And so while here in the United States, you know, we can still get food, but it's become much more expensive. Same with gas. And this goes to my sort of bigger point and my main response to the questioner, which is, even if you think that government might have a legitimate role, even if you in setting caps on how much carbon we're going to use or pricing carbon or, you know, pollution or something like that, I'm very pessimistic about its ability to perform that role well, in part because when Europe has tried to set carbon caps, they have failed in many cases to actually get countries and get industries to abide by those caps because the politics of it are really bad. Look at what is happening in the United States right now, where gas prices have gone up, not to a level where it is like a nationwide catastrophe, but where it is a real stress on a lot of people's budgets. It is absolutely the number one political issue, and it is going to drive elections for several years here. It has driven, you know, it's taken Biden's poll numbers down to where we talked about earlier, down into the low 30s, because people are really mad about the increased cost of gasoline, and the increased cost of gasoline is driving up the cost of food. And so I just think that the likelihood that politics is going to be an effective tool for controlling and managing climate change is low. The single best thing that I have read about global warming at length over the last year or two is Neal Stephenson's novel Termination Shock. Now, it's obviously a novel, but it's a novel of big ideas in which he basically says, look, climate change looks like a real serious problem over the next 100 years. And it starts by and it sort of walks through a bunch of the kind of political solutions, and basically it is a dramatic argument for the idea that political solutions that try to do everything top down and holistically just aren't going to work because there's too many committees, too much bureaucracy, too much politics involved. And so instead, the way that this is going to be solved is through engineering, and not by engineering your way out of the problem in a big way, not by like, oh man, we're going to create a whole dome around the earth and it's just going to solve the global warming problem. Instead, we're going to solve it one little problem at a time. So it starts in a couple of decades in the future in Texas, and people, and like global warming has changed Texas. So people wear environment suits a little bit like the suits in Dune, right, to keep them cool. Many houses have been built on stilts because there's flooding and it's kind of a problem. It's changed the way that energy is delivered. In fact, one of the main characters in the novel is the Dutch queen, the Queen of the Netherlands, who is facing significant, you know, sort of flooding issues because of global warming. And there's a great, great, like classic Neal Stephenson scene in which the Maeslandt Caring, which is the Maeslandt Barrier, which is this gigantic sort of movable flood barrier that allows ships into a sort of port area and out, but also can close when there's flooding. This is one of the largest movable objects in the world. It's just an incredible feat of engineering. And you know what? In Neal Stephenson's novel, it fails. And it fails because sometimes engineering fails and there's a problem, yeah, and that creates problems.
No, but
this is what I think is basically going to get us through this, is not that
novels.
We are going to,
Matt,
like, have a commission,
yeah,
where the EU and the Congress and Joe Biden and like Marco Rubio and whoever the hell else all get together in a room and solve global warming with like a, you know, with a bunch
no,
of
but,
regulations.
But wait, let's
what
not,
gonna, what's going to solve
it
is like a bunch
global
of people
warming.
Solving their own problems. And there will, like, this will not be a solution that people like in a lot of ways. It will not be perfect. It won't be ideal. It will just sort of allow us to muddle through one step at a time.
Can I ask Matt Welch, who grew up in Southern California, why is the air quality in Southern California tremendously better than it was when you were born? And was that because of novels? Was it because of a lack of government action? And I'm not saying the government action was perfect. I here am representing the libertarian end of reason, because when people say, you know, if you grant maybe that the government has a right or, you know, has a role in, you know, maintaining or improving the environment, you know, the fact is that the top-down decision to get rid of leaded gasoline to go to unleaded gasoline, which has a bunch of problems related to it, including, you know, the mandate that all vehicles had to have catalytic converters in order to clean certain amount, you know, certain pollutants coming out of cars. You know, that's bad policy. But there's no fucking question that the reason why the air is better in the U.S. right now is because in the late 60s and early 70s, a bunch of laws that were badly, you know, enforced and implemented, but nonetheless were super effective, so that you have a point now where there are massive, you know, so many more people living in places like LA and Houston that have terrible air quality, and the air quality today is much cleaner. And it didn't happen out of the blue. So I think we can start, if we want to be serious and in a conversation, and this is not saying we need one world government that does this or that for, you know, a carbon tax or climate change, but like, let's live in reality and admit that, you know, the air is cleaner in Southern California because of specific government actions that have been largely effective in cleaning the air.
I grew up not being able to see the mountains 20 miles away for 90% of the year, and now you can 90% of the year, and that difference is phenomenal. I think it's part of a subset that is widely kind of understood as the Kuznets curve. Just do a search on the Reason site for that. But as societies become richer, they get cleaner. They get cleaner partly because of there's a more political demand for those types of programs and for those programs to be effective. They also get cleaner because richer production styles are better. You know, they're just
cleaner or better, just cleaner, or more effective.
All you have to do to see how central planning is not only impoverishes people, but absolutely belches filth into the air is to visit any currently communist country or to have lived in former communist countries. Just absolutely awful.
And to put a point on what you started, you mentioned, Matt, you know, the fact that, and this is where the argument needs to be made, is that like you have Greens, you know, literal Greens, Green Party members in Germany, because of a stupid ideology, saying, I want to burn coal rather than reinstitute clean nuclear energy in Germany, which they shut down recently. Like, there's a lot to debate here, but I think the broader context, if we're going to say, you know what, like, just let the market fix everything, that's not the world right. That we've lived in, and it's
but
not the world.
But
that
the flip side of that too, Nick, is that don't do things that hamper the creation of wealth that produces both demand and solutions, including Suderman style novel solutions for these things. Okay, do we have time for lightning round? Nope. Yep. I'm going to insist on it because I wanted to talk about it and give a shout out to our pal John Stossel. Last week he had a piece that he's been kind of asking people for a long time, a simple question: how would you change the Constitution? So I want to go, and by lightning round, I mean lightning round, starting with Slade. How would you change the Constitution? Go.
I mean, I like that people are starting to talk about changes to how we vote, including ranked choice voting and things like that, marginal changes about how we structure our elections. I'm open to these conversations.
Okay, so you're open to it. That's not how you would change the Constitution, but you're saying you're open to tweaking the voting mechanism. Go in.
Matt, I will jump in. In the spirit of a lightning round, I would take the 9th and 10th Amendments and move those to like 2nd and 3rd. Okay, because I think more things should be, you know, the decentralization factor should be higher up, but especially the unenumerated rights. The idea that, you know, what the Constitution is talking about, what government can and can't do, you know, specifically, but then leave more stuff to individuals in particular, not to states. States don't have rights. Individuals have rights.
Suderman, how would you change the Constitution? And you can't say the name Neal Stephenson. Go.
Neal Stephenson, I would have never allowed the 18th Amendment to pass.
Okay.
Had caused prohibition, guys.
Yeah. Well,
we just wouldn't have done
repealed
that.
Yes. So how would you change the Constitution? Is this a hard question? Is this a question that's a little
hard? Well, what would you do, Matt Welch?
I would include, besides having the no, really, we mean it thing put on many of, if not most of, not just the amendments, but on various, you know, Congress will be the one to declare war kind of thing. No, really, we mean it. No, I would have an amendment that specifically outlaws the use of a military draft or any kind of national service or registration for a servitude towards the government. I would say make that off limits altogether. If you want to raise an army, good luck. but you don't get to have the draft. And if he really means that much to you, you can pass a constitutional amendment, right? But it's prohibited. All right, that's how I would do it. Let's go to our what you would or have been consuming on the cultural sphere. Nick, why don't you start us off?
So I watched the first episode of a 6-part series on HBO, a documentary series called The Anarchists, and it is about an anarchist community in Acapulco, Mexico, or was in Acapulco, built around an annual event called Anarcapulco that took place several years in a row, coordinated or organized by Jeff Berwick, a libertarian money guy who is now living in the Dominican Republic. And it is a story of anarchism, annual events, and ultimately murder. It's really important. There's a cast of characters that includes Ron Paul, Roger Ver, the early Bitcoin magnate, Judge Napolitano, David Icke, the insane former British soccer player turned, Keith Olbermann turned conspiracy freakazoid. It is fantastic. So check out HBO's The Anarchists.
Judge Napolitano kill?
Well, you know what? He
gotta
is.
Tune in to find out.
Yeah.
No spoilers.
That's the question. He did not. He gives life. He gives life support to freedom. Everywhere he goes, Matt. He's the Heimlich maneuver. He's an ideological Heimlich maneuver, Judge Knapp is. But it's a good series that from the inside, too, the filmmaker, the director of the documentary series had access to everybody. And it's a great topic that will be of interest to virtually everybody who listens to the Reason Roundtable, and it should draw a large audience. So The Anarchists, about the kind of large world, kind of orbiting Anarcapulco, defunct event in Acapulco.
That's the worst name.
And I can't pronounce possible.
I'm never going to even try. Slade, what have you been consuming?
So about 2 weeks ago, I attended, as I usually do, the Acton Institute's big annual summer conference in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And while there, I had a chance to do an early screening of their new documentary, The Hong Konger, which is a documentary about the life of Jimmy Lai, the Chinese dissident, businessman, and founder of Apple Daily, which was one of the only independent news sources left in Hong Kong until they, following the Hong Kong national security law, arrested Jimmy Lai and seized his assets and eventually, shuttered the Apple Daily, this newspaper that he had founded and had been running. So this is his life story. I mean, he's still in prison, so it's an ongoing story, but it's a pretty amazing one. The documentary has not been released yet. It's sort of making the film festival circuit right now, but I thought it was quite good. Full disclosure, I have an affiliation with Acton. As of a few months ago, I'm a fellow in liberal studies at Acton Institute, but I was in no way, I was not involved with this documentary. I just saw it for the first time 2 weeks ago, but I thought it was quite good. So if you have a chance to view it at a film festival or once it's released, or if you are in a position to potentially host a screening, they're looking for partner organizations to host screenings of the documentary. Check it out again. It's called The Hong Konger, and it's a new documentary by the Acton Institute.
If I may just very quickly put a plug in for a in-depth interview with Simon Lee, who worked very closely with Jimmy Lai, by Reason Zach Weismuller. Go to the reason.com site and type in Jimmy Lai, L-A-I, and Simon Lee and Zach Weismuller, and it will make you more interested in seeing this documentary if you aren't already, and you should be.
Suderman, what have you been consuming?
So I saw Thor 4, and it was bad, but mostly I want to talk about seeing the band Karate at the Black Cat
Washington, D.C. What was that, a bait and switch?
Yeah,
I thought you were
going to
talk, what is Thor 4? Is like Grits and Thunder or something like that?
Love and Thunder,
okay.
Nick. But that is exactly what Karate brought to the Black Cat. So this is this old kind of mathy jazz punk band. It's like basically these guys loved Fugazi and John Coltrane and like Rites of Spring and Mineral in the 1990s. And so they were part of the sort of that scene, but from Boston, all classically trained musicians. In fact, the lead singer is, I believe, a college music professor at this point. They've been they released a bunch of albums in the 1990s and the early aughts that got increasingly sort of noodly, jazzy, and kind of brainy, sort of growing out of their punk rock roots. And then they broke up in 2005 and just got back together this year. And so this is the fourth show I've seen at the Black Cat this year. Every single one of the bands I have seen has been playing since at least the late 1990s. And it's just been a great experience to go and see these old punk rocker types. Not always punk rock, but like I saw, you know, Pedro the Lion, and I saw Cursive, and I saw Destroyer, who's this like weird Canadian art rock guy who's been, you know, in like the New Pornographers and kind of bumming around the indie rock scene since the late 90s. And every one of these bands is just such a joy to watch because the Black Cat is... It's like, it feels like home to me. I mean, I spent so much time there in my 20s, didn't really go a lot in my 30s, but it's like returning to like a place where I was, you know, when I was like a young man, and like this was like a place I hung out. Like there was a bar there that no longer exists. And so like there's this like kind of nostalgic thing going on, but also you see these bands and they no longer have anything to prove. They're not trying to be cool anymore. They're just playing for 300 or 400 people in like a weird little room in the middle of Washington. And the stakes are both low and like kind of right. And it's like the stakes are low at this point, right? They're not going to become big bands. They're not trying to like make their careers at this point. They're just playing because they love playing music.
For love of the game.
Yeah, and they're playing for people who just came because they love the music. This isn't like a big fancy venue. There's not like a big light show. The stage, you know, I mean, there's a stage and a little bit of lights, but you can, half the time you can barely see the band if, you know, there's 6 foot tall dude standing in front of you. And it's just, it's so pleasantly low key. But the bands take the music seriously. And there is something really wonderful about it, not really mattering except for the thing itself, right? There's nothing else going on. It's just, here's the music. We love playing it. You love listening to it. Have a cheap beer and enjoy. Thank you.
Love the Black Cat as a venue. Matt, when you hear classically trained rock star, who do you think of?
I think of the abominable Mr. Frank Zappa. Yeah. By which I mean he's super awesome.
I think of the beauteous Pat Benatar.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. We used to say trained. That about Freddie Mercury.
Has like a 12 octave voice. She has like 30 octaves.
Zappa isn't classically trained. He just seems like he was. He trained himself. Which is
anyone who wants to experience the Cursive live thing, they do have a live album titled, I believe, 545. Because it was a high-quality recording of their 545th show. This was back in the early, mid-aughts. They played something like 750 shows over the existence of the band.
Is Suderman been recommending five different things here? How's this?
No, by the way, if you want to experience the karate show that I have already seen.
Now, what about the
Thor Breakfast
at Wendy's? Thor 4?
The Rock of the Westies. We'll have to save that
album. That's like the best.
Another one. I'm going to wrap this up with a turd bow, which is to say that I was on vacation.
A poop ribbon?
Recently, last night.
Disney West,
as you do sometimes on vacation.
Did you watch this week?
Oh, there's a television in this room that my family are in. How unique is that? Let us scroll on the television and select something. Because as if
my mother, the car. You watch the entire series, Matt. You're
as
here to report on it.
We don't have a television at home.
Do not have iPads with the Netflix.
I would like to murder you. all. No, what we did is
no, just me. We know
we it's just two of the three. We were scrolling and my 7-year-old was with me, and there was a show that had like a Minions logo. She's like, do that one. So we did it, and it had nothing to do really with the Minions, but it was a television program that's called American Ninja Warrior. Apparently it's been going on for 14 seasons. I'd never heard of it.
Oh my God, Matt Welch.
Not living in the real America. And we sat, and it's a show where people crawl over and climb over various arduous things, and they
do the salmon run where they put the bars up.
Which is very, very difficult.
It's too much.
My
fantastic.
Shoulders start aching just watching.
It's the only thing standing between us and an invasion by Russia.
Sadly,
Putin is looking at American Ninja Warrior, and it's like, you know, teachers, special ed teachers, substitute teachers, like making the entire thing.
I'm here really sadly has nothing to do with the 1985 movie American Ninja, starring Michael Dudikoff.
Are you recommending that one?
So good.
Oh, he's so good in everything.
Yeah. So,
which is itself calls to mind Gymkhana with Kyle Rowe
Jr. I'm here to tell you. The way that the seasons work, it's like... it's like
you're here
eight primetime specials, or I don't know what the hell. It's a successful program is what I'm telling you. It's great. It is just, I was riveted. There's like a 16-year-old girl with like type 2 diabetes and a little arm thing doing the stuff. There was a firefighter who lost a foot. There were like comical, weird.
He lost the foot before the competition, right? Not in the competition.
There is a guy, the guy who was really good was like super short, and he had like I can't grow problem. I think that's what it's called medically. And you know, he's there to be an inspiration to all about anybody who's bullied in middle school. There's like a couple who spend their days dressed one as a shark and the other as a lobster. I don't know why. I'm not going to kink shame. And they bond over American Ninjing. It just absolutely wonderfully disposable, thrilling, dramatic competition. Can't recommend it highly enough. I will probably never watch it again. But if I do, I'll be happy that I did. It was really fun. American Ninja Warrior made me feel, I was watching right before July 4th. It made me feel even more patriotic than I normally do. All right. That's all the patriotism we have time for here. The Reason Roundtable podcast. Go to all of our podcasts, Reason.com podcasts, including the Soho Forum series, The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, plus the new brand spanking new Reason Rundown with Peter Suderman. It's very exciting. Check it out. We're doing lots of podcasting now. And if you like the material that we offer for you on all of our channels and tubes, please go to reason.com/donate. You can give us money. We're a 501c3 nonprofit. We thrive with your dollars.
Tax deductible donation.
Nick Gillespie. All right. That's all the time we have. We will see you next Monday, and goodbye.